Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology. My name is Michael Johnston. I am the host of this podcast, and this is a channel on New Books Network. Today, I have Alex Colas, Jason Edwards, Jane Levi, and Samuel Zubeda with me to discuss their book, Food Politics and Society, Social Theory and Modern Food Systems. Thank you for joining me today. Alex Colas is a reader in international relations at Birkbeck College, University of London, and is the director of the postgraduate program on international security and global governance. He is the author of Empire and International Civil Society, and also the book we'll be discussing today. Jason Edwards is a lecturer in politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, and is program director of the MSc in Social and Political Theory. He is the author of The Radical Attitude of Modern Political Theory and the editor of Retrieving the Big Society. Jane Levi is a visiting research fellow in history at King's College, London, and is King's Mount Vernon Fellow 2017-2018. She has contributed to numerous scholarly volumes on food, including the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets and the Sage Encyclopedia of Food and Food Issues. Sammy Zubeda is Emeritus Professor of Politics and Sociology at Birkbeck College, University of London, and is a Fellow of Birkbeck College, Research Associate of the London Middle East Institute, and Professorial Research Associate of the Food Studies Center at SOAS. His books include Islam, The People in the State, Political Ideas and Movements in the Middle East, and A Taste of Time, Culinary Cultures of the Middle East. Again, thank you for joining us. Could you start off by maybe giving us a little bit of a background on how all of you came together to collaborate on this book?
Well, I'll take that one, Michael. This is Jason Edwards here. Well, we all teach or have taught at Birkbeck College for a number of years, and initially there was a rather informal start to this in the sense that Alex and I were thinking about what kind of courses that we might put on. And we'd known Sammy, who's now emeritus professor, but taught for a very long time at Birkbeck and has been teaching and researching about food, particularly the food of the Middle East, for a very long time. And there was also a kind of informality there in the sense that we enjoyed many meals together, including around at Sammy's house. And this idea gradually came together really on the basis of Sammy's expertise and our sort of slightly more amateur interest that we might teach a course at Birkbeck on food politics and society. And then I think Alex and I were introduced to Jane by Sammy as well. Jane has also been doing a great deal of research on food and the sociology of food and anthropology of food. So that's how it began, was with a fairly speculative attempt to teach a course to undergraduates, and that was back in, I think, about 2012, 2013, and we've had three or four iterations of the course since then, but we found that the students liked the course very much, and I think we came together and gave it a coherence that originally perhaps we might not have foreseen. And through that saw that there might be room for us to sit down together and work on a volume. And that then was the initial starting point for the book. And where we coincided, I think, was in both our interests in history, the history and politics of food, but also the fact that we are all teachers of, in one way or another, teachers of things that involve thinking through concepts from social theory, very broadly speaking. I'm actually count myself as a political theorist, but there's an overlap there, I think, very clearly between the concepts that we employ in political theory and social theory. So it's around that theme, really, that we began to build the book, thinking conceptually, thinking about the key concepts and ideas that we were teaching on the course that had to do with things like the social and the natural, that had to do with markets and exchange, that had to do with the state and the public sphere and identity. All of these concepts, which we explored in a primarily historical vein, but also a significant part of the course had an eye on contemporary issues to do with politics and society and food. And we worked through those concepts and the historical sociological material that we had at our disposal for teaching the course. And hey presto, we ended up with a manuscript. That was finished up, I don't know, about 18 months ago now, I think. We had the manuscript, and the book was published just last October. It was October, wasn't it? Yeah. Was it November? Yeah, November last year. So that's the kind of that's the potted history of the volume.
Excellent. And the interest of food. Why food and drink? What is so social about it? Particularly, I think maybe in part, I'm maybe applying a little bit of an answer to this. But food seems to be extremely private. What makes it so public and so much more social than one might see at first blush?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because that's often how we do think about food. It's to do with the biological. It's to do with bodies and reproducing bodies over time. But you know, as soon as you take the position that the food we eat is something that can only be produced through the cooperation of many people in complex social and economic systems, and of course, complex social and economic systems always require governance in one way or another. You very quickly, when you start thinking through this, realize that the production and the consumption, the distribution of food is always reliant on these broader economic and political processes, institutions, and relations. And of course, the idea that perhaps we take for granted in everyday life, but as soon as we reflect on it, we realize that food is deeply mediated by culture, just the way that we think about different kinds of national cuisines or ethnic cuisines, that tells you that food leaves a strong imprint on identity, and vice versa. The kinds of food that we eat, the way we eat those foods, has a very important effect on people's social identity, but also on their political identities, and that's part of what we wanted to bring out in the book. So that's the sense in which I think food is always, to put it in a very broad and schematic way, food is always social rather than about the individual and individual biology.
And one of the things that you and your colleagues brought out in your book is the concept of we are what we eat. Are we what we eat, or is it an ongoing negotiation that occurs between the social construction of food and our gastronomy versus what we eat creating us as a person, as an identity, as a race, or whatever else it may be based on what we eat?
I think it's all of the above. That the simplicity of the notion that we are what we eat is actually incredibly complicated and filled with all those layers, should you choose to look at them. So there's obviously a biological imperative, but there's almost nothing that is inedible, but there are many different ideas about what is edible. So a gastronomic body is a very different body to other kinds of body that are defined. So,
well, if I may come in, yes, I mean, you are what you eat also in the cultural and social sense, in that what you eat is very much tied up with your style of life, with your social networks, with your evaluation of your status in society, with your economic capabilities and your income and wealth, and the way in which all these elements in your social and cultural being are signaled by the kind of food that you eat and the cultural context within which you eat it and the way in which you conceive and conceptualize and broadcast what your gastronomic profile is and how that relates to your social status and to your cultural being.
And I think also it becomes a way of others judging you. It can be almost an accusation in sort of public health terms that, you know, if you are ill or if you are the wrong kind of body for the social, the society you're in, then you are what you eat and you have made poor choices and you have eaten the wrong things. So it can be used very negatively as well.
This is particularly topical now in all our societies because fat is an issue and the whole idea of the body and health and what fat does and the kind of stereotypes of different body types is very much a very live social issues in the news, in the media at the present time. And the book delves into that in a detailed way and sums up the literature and the various kind of theories that revolve around it.
And the tribalism that is associated with food. If I remember correctly, one of the tribes that you had mentioned was an African tribe where the women would go into a feeding ritual prior to marriage. And that is really the cultural construct, the how culture deals with food and based on the definition and the meaning that is associated with such food and drink within tribes across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, I think picking up on your last point, one of the points that we make in the book is that one of the dominant ways of understanding food is through a national or ethnic identity. And the chapter in the book that deals with these themes raises the argument that we're invited as individuals and as collectivities to homogenize, standardize, identifying in the literal sense certain types of ethnic or national foods. So there's a dynamic process involved, which we really highlight throughout the book. I mean, the book suggests that there's something very specific in the modern period that happens to all societies but affects the consumption, production, preparation of food and drink. And that is that there's a transformation, a radical transformation, revolution of those various dimensions of production, consumption, preparation. There's also stratification that goes with it. Mentioned some of the ways in which distinction is created amongst classes, amongst genders, amongst ethnic groups. But critically, this is also part of the dynamic process. There's a globalization. There's a geographical expansion of different food identities and admixture of varieties of foodstuffs and drinks, which means that through the past 400 or 500 years, by through force or through choice, and often the two are difficult to disentangle, different collectivities, be they the kind of African women that you're describing in perhaps a more rural context, of kinship, or be it the, you know, hipsters in some of the global cities, have to deal with, deliberately, consciously or not, have to engage with all those various factors: change, distinction, and also the fact that they're in entangled in wider transnational relations.
I think one of the important elements to consider here is the wide-scale movement of populations in the modern period, you know, since the 19th century, and the migrations that have happened internationally and the diasporas. So in the Americas, for instance, you have a large array of people from all over the world, including many parts of Europe. And these people now, given that they are different ethnic and national communities in many of the global cities in Europe and America and elsewhere, and all these have their own groceries and restaurants and food writers and food broadcasts and what have you. So now you have an international stage on which different ethnicities and nationalities are sort of presenting their food and competing with one another, and also claiming different items of food as their own national or ethnic property, and in the process transforming these cuisines, both in their diasporic locations, but also with feedback into their countries of origin. So, in fact, one argument being presented by a historian of Italian food is to say that that Italian food, which is famous for its diversity of its regional nature, is really developed as a national Italian food in the diaspora context of the Americas, both in the North America and in places like Argentina and Brazil. And then, you know, presented to the world in the way in which it has developed in these diasporic contexts.
And that brings up a concept that I find quite interesting, and that's a concept of authenticity. And what is authentic food then in a world of social of social omnivores, people who are accessing a variety of foods, maybe at the higher economic statuses, just more of those foods.
Yeah, authenticity. So what is food authenticity today? I think that's the
food authenticity. Well, I mean, food authenticity is, you know, people claim various things as authentic. Well, how they are, you know, how do they relate historically is a different matter. And to whom do they belong? I mean, one example that we have in the book is this kind of gastronomic or food area, which is now becoming globally famous. That's what's called the Eastern Mediterranean, and which is really southern part of Turkey, of Anatolia, parts of Greece and Cyprus, and the Arab Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and now Israel. And these that area has sort of common food themes, and indeed other common cultural themes, but it has multiple ethnicities. So within that area, you have Turks and Kurds and Arabs and Greeks and Armenians. They all more or less share in this food repertoire. And then once you get into the international stage of globalization and diasporas, then each of these ethnicities can claim the food as their own, which, you know, which is fine. But, you know, in actual fact, it's really to do much more with geography than it is to do with ethnicity. It is that particular region that had a distinctive food culture, which was shared by all these different ethnicities.
I think if I can just add another angle to this, and it relates to something that Jason opened up at the beginning and is central to actually the one of the first chapters of the book, and that is the relationship between the social and the natural. It seems to me that in our period in particular, 21st and 20th century, authenticity is often associated to the natural. And yet what we highlight in the book is that the natural is itself social. And I think this is manifest in foodstuffs. If we think, for instance, of the way in which all kinds of social and political institutions naturalize foodstuffs or drink through denominations of origin would be an example. An institution like the European Union, I'm sure that in the US, the USDA would be another example. A whole bunch of other public authorities, including local authorities, the state, entities that regulate standards, create the notion of a full fat or an authentic or a natural product. In other words, we need all this infrastructure of identifying the natural, marking it with a particular register, and giving it that quality through deeply social and political institutions. And I think that's one way of thinking of authenticity in a paradoxical way, as something that is manufactured.
And I say that's right when we're Alex is pointing to this link between perceptions of the natural and authenticity, and that's one way in which, if you want to broaden the question out, people try and find the authentic in the modern world. In many respects, that's a feature of modernity, or even you might see it as a reaction to modernity, this quest for what is authentic. But also, just to follow up on what Alex was saying there, it's very interesting how the question of authenticity, what Alex and Sammy were saying, the question of authenticity has come to be identified with something that's recently been coined gastro-nationalism. So it's in a way, it's a fairly old idea. It's the idea that you can identify a nation with its cuisine and with particular dishes that form the substance of that cuisine, whether it's, you know, fish and chips in the United Kingdom, though of course now there's a debate on whether that is the national dish here, or rather it's chicken tikka masala. But nonetheless, you do get this idea of identification between the nation and what it eats. And that is actually playing quite a significant role in the what we might think of as a resurgence of nationalism in recent years, and kind of populist nationalism. So it's a reclamation of identity through restoring our authentic foods and ways of eating. And there's something of a tension there between, I think, the movements that wanted to restore this link between authenticity and the natural, like the slow food movement, for example, in a country like Italy, and actually these much more nationalist conceptions of what it means to be a member of a nation that can be, you know, indexed to the kinds of food that you eat.
And that brings up food symbolism, the message that is projected, the definition that is projected based on what food has been created as, almost creating an environment with the food that is associated with a city or a country. One of the interesting symbolisms that I think you brought out in the book is with religion and what wine or grape juice symbolizes within the church and the bread.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I suppose one of the things that we talk about throughout the book is that food is not simply an item to eat. It's not ever just what it looks like it is on the tin. So we project, in the way that we've talked about already in terms of identity and nationalism and so on, we project any idea that we that is important to us onto the object of everyday life, and food is so fundamental to our bodies and our being that I think it's a rich source for that kind of projection. And it's also a really useful mode of control. So it's a handy thing to construct rules around if you wish to run a system in which you have people obeying specific rules. And I guess where food's concerned, that's not restricted to religious movements, but they do provide us with very convenient and structured and documented examples that we can use to think about those ideas.
All right. And some other things that, one other thing that was brought up in this book is the diets and whether there's a single true method, or if these are all just cultural constructions, social constructions to get people to desire certain food groups. Could you talk a little bit more on that?
Yes. I mean, I suppose biologically it's clear that, you know, we require a certain balance of inputs. You know, you can't, to use another cliched phrase, you know, man cannot live on bread alone, because we need variety, we need different elements and so on. But I think if you're referring to the part of the book where we talk about national guidelines for what people ought to eat in order to be healthy, then yes, I think it's a very very conflicted area, because just by the very nature of looking at a few of them, we can see that different groups think that a healthy diet is something specific for them that is different to what others require. And I think we also see that the bodies who are putting together these advisory guidelines are themselves influenced by what they understand their culture to be, to the extent that they might feel they know what people ought to do, i.e. never eat any junk food or limit sugar to a few grams a day, but they don't in a way dare to put that advice into practice because they feel so sure that the culture will not accept those recommendations. So there's a lot of compromise in what people will advise based on how they think the people will receiving advice will accept it or not. And those ideas are coming from our culture.
And at the end of the day, I think value associated with food has a lot to do with exchange and the mobility of food from one nation to the next. And that, in some sense, it's some level of nationalism, but also globalism in the same sense of how that food is identified, how it's valued based on where it's coming from, based on the cultural narratives that are associated with those places in which they are delivered or extracted from. Could you talk a little bit more about the Colombian exchange and mercantilism?
Yeah, so there's actually two chapters in the book that are interconnected. The first one that you mentioned is the Colombian exchange, a well-known phrase that refers to that exchange of goods, of livestock, of people and what people brought with them, of course, great things like languages and different kind of religious or cosmological views, but also bad things like disease and most importantly for us, power structures. So throughout the book, we emphasize, I think I mentioned this just a minute ago, our globalist disposition. I mean, we say very explicitly that it's impossible to think of the modern food system without thinking of the transnational and since the Colombian exchange of the 15th century onwards, the global exchange of foodstuffs. But what we're also very keen to emphasize is that that exchange is not neutral. It's uneven, it's unequal, it's protracted. In the book, we actually use the example of the potato, for instance, which unquestionably has had a global effect as a major staple, major source of calorific intake, particularly for popular classes, for peasants and subsequently workers. But the history of the diffusion of the potato globally is actually quite staggered. In fact, it comes to the rest of the Eurasian world through different in stops and starts. Initially, not accepted as a comestible for humans, but mainly fodder for animals. And really, on most accounts, it's not until the late 18th century that it becomes extensively used as a staple. And of course, we have historical examples of close to monoculture in the case of the plantation of potatoes in the Irish colony in Ireland as a colony, which had great consequences for the subsequent history of that island and indeed Britain through the potato famine of the mid 19th century. So exchange is absolutely central to the contemporary food system. It generates an intensification of processes that had happened prior to the 16th century, namely the admixture of foodstuffs, of the combination of techniques, the experimentation in different kinds of tastes and concoctions, but and it generates wonderful abundance of food in many respects. Again, one thinks of the history of European gastronomy over the past 400 or 500 years, and it's impossible not to find traces of American staples, be it the tomato or the potato or all kinds of corn, obviously, of all kinds of very important foodstuffs that have contributed to our culinary, our global culinary cuisine. But the critical thing here from our perspective, what brings a distinctive political and social dimension is that, as Jane was saying earlier, food is never just something that we ingest. Food and drink are not merely fuel. They carry all kinds of social and political attributes that involve power, that involve identity, that involve inequality. And that's why the subtitle of the book brings in social theory. Our proposition is that in order to understand the rich admixture of foodstuffs and cuisines through this global exchange, we need to also factor in concepts like Michel Foucault's notion of biopower or Marx's notion of exploitation or Mary Douglas's understandings of how there are different codings to the way in which food is prepared, or prohibitions, taboos. To summarize this part of the discussion, I think that what we're bringing to the table, if you'll excuse the pun, is the notion that it's all very well celebrating. We should celebrate the hybridity of foods, the fusion cuisines, the fact that food and drink are now on a global stage, as Sammy was talking about earlier. But our proposal is that in order to really get to the bottom of the social and political impact of this, we need the canon of modern social theory. We need the grammar of concepts that we have available and that is indeed developing in order to really get to the bottom of the impact of these exchanges.
And that even goes a step deeper, not only the food that is produced, but the ritual is holistic. It's not just the food that is being produced, but also the rituals carried out when consuming that food.
Yeah. and the language used to talk about it. And I mean, I suppose in a way that can refer back to the discussion earlier about authenticity, but it applies to all sorts of language we use to talk about food and the implicit judgments that are layered within those ideas. So, you know, who decides that authenticity is even a good thing in the first place? Who decides what actually is authentic? What my idea of what an authentic, I don't know, loaf of bread is will be very different to almost everyone else's, and who's wrong, and why does it matter? So I think, yeah, all of those questions come into that idea about how we serve food and who gets what and when and where.
Yes, I think if we look at the historical dimension to the question of authenticity and how people think about food, I was very struck to read a book about the food of France, which was written in the 1930s, 1940s, and to see how so many items of French food are transformed now, even though they may be called by the same words, by the same labels. They are so completely transformed by new ingredients or different ingredients, by different methods, methods of preservation, methods of the kitchen technology, and what have you. And yet people still cling to the old labels and think of their food as being authentic in terms of historical continuity. Yeah, that was always like this. But in actual fact, you know, within a half a century, the food was transformed, but still people thought of it in terms of the authentic historical type of food.
Yeah, they sort of believe it has a meaning, and but that meaning sort of secretly changes over time, and becomes, you know, the language is changed. The objects are changed by their place in consumer societies. So these are all, on another level, they're all marketing messages. So, you know, you may only have access to the authentic if you can afford to pay for it.
I think it serves both the opposing forces. Food brings solidarity, but then also results in inequalities as well. I often think of maybe Ray Oldenburg and Great Good Places and food and drink serving as a thing to manifest and bringing people together, creating community.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it does both of those things. And what's interesting in a way, and this is reflected in a couple of chapters in the book on the public sphere and also partly on the modern state and alcohol, is the way in which spaces which are in many respects designed to reinforce inequality, whether that be inequality or segregation or exclusion in terms of class or gender or race, those spaces of consumption can be transformed and subverted by the very practices of sociable eating that goes on in them. So we talk in the book about the gin craze in London in the early 18th century, and how there was an attempt to crack down on what was seen as the fundamental moral problem of people drinking, particularly women, it should be said, drinking far too much gin. And part of that involved getting rid of the old spaces of sociable drinking where men and women would openly drink together. And as a result of that, later on in the 18th century, and the 19th century, there's creation of new spaces of drinking, which are segregated, internally segregated. So you find, you know, the people think of the sort of classic London pub, the Victorian pub, the Gin Palace, has internal segregation of rooms. And initially, that was designed to keep working class men away from middle class people and to keep women and men away from each other. But actually, these sites of drinking themselves generated new forms of political identity, including quite radical political identities, which challenged the kind of, you know, supposedly inherent conservatism of the Victorian age. So it's interesting how spaces which are designed to keep people apart, to keep them unequal, actually can become places where solidarity and identity, political identities can be formed, which challenge the existing order of things.
And then the commensality.
Yep.
Assists that,
yes,
that development.
Yeah, that idea of commensality, of, you know, being together at a table and, you know, primarily eating together, but that leads to other kinds of things, and those things can include the formation of, you know, groups which have a political intent.
This conversation has been a joy to have, and I appreciate having you on the show. Unfortunately, it has come that time where we have to bring our conversation to a close. What are the next steps? What are all of you working on now?
Ooh, various kinds of things. I mean, we hope to keep going in one form or another with the course we're teaching here. A couple of us are working on something that's going on over here in the UK at the moment called Brexit, and the implications that has for food, the way that we produce and consume food here in the UK and our relationship with the European Union. And then others may be able to speak for themselves about what they're doing in terms of their food work.
Well, I'm writing various papers, and particular thing I'm interested in at the moment is the ideas and descriptions of French food in the Anglo-Saxon world, both Britain and America, from, you know, in the very different stages in the 20th century, and how that has changed, and how, you know, different kind of from French food as utopia to French food as a critical decline that many writers have in more recent years, and to see what the food was that they were describing and how the ideologies of national cuisines emerged from that.
And I'm working on two projects. One of them is working on the Georgian papers that with colleagues at King's College London. So thinking there about the link between the development of statesmanship and the non-royal and slightly less elite statesman in that period. And my contribution is thinking about the role of food in such diplomatic and social activity, and to move away from the intellectual slightly, one of my biggest interests is in utopianism and food, and I have a project. I've set up a co-op with a group of colleagues, and we have a project at Somerset House, a big building in London, where we're doing some urban food growing as a utopian art and culture project. So every now and again, I'm to be found in the former coal holes of Somerset House growing oyster mushrooms.
And finally, I've got very little to say. I'm working with Jason on the Brexit thing, but my main interest is in internationalism. And I think that one of the ways in which food crosses that, and I'm trying to educate myself and build a body of knowledge that might eventually become something else, is the cross-section between food and empire. I mean, it's a massive arena, but I'm very interested in, to coin a phrase, the creative destruction of imperial experiences, of modern imperial experiences, and how we have both the kinds of domination of oppression that I've referred to, but also a sort of subversion of the codes of the racial and national codes of empire with the emergence of Creole foods and hybrid foods. So hopefully that will emerge in future years.
Well, thank you for joining me today on this podcast. This has been an episode of New Books in Sociology. Again, we're a channel on New Books Network. Have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.